This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Sarah D'Elia, in for Mike Collins. For over a decade, Durham native and Duke graduate Heather Havrileski has been giving advice to the heartsick and emotionally lost and confused. She's the author of a weekly advice column called Ask Polly, featured in New York Magazine, and now the author of a new book called How to Be a Person in the World, a collection of the greatest hits of her advice column with some new gems mixed in. Her advice is funny, smart, and geared towards those who may or may not be experiencing some sort of existential crisis. Some recent questions she's answered in her column include, aren't some people just doomed to be miserable? How do I stop being a fake? And am I too selfish? She joins us now from her home in LA. Heather, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be talking to you guys.
So we get a lot of books sent to us at the station, I have to say, and sometimes it's easy to gloss over them because we get so many. But when I saw yours, it immediately caught my eye because of the title, How to Be a Person in the World, because it's honestly something that I spend a lot of time thinking, and I'm guessing that your readers and our listeners think about too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I actually have been writing my column, Ask Polly, for... It appears on New York Magazine's The Cut. It's been there for, I've been writing it for 4 years total. And I actually got the title from someone who tweeted a link to my column and said, if you want to know how to be a person in the world, actually there was a bad word in the, there was some swearing in it, but it was like, if you want to know how to be a person in the world, read this column. And I thought, how to be a person in the world? So I can't really take credit for it, but I kind of feel like, you know, the challenge of being a person in the world is a real challenge these days in particular. So it felt like a good title.
Well, and you mentioned that you've been writing your advice column for 4 years, but you've been dispensing, you know, advice for over a decade. Why did you decide to release the book now?
Well, let's see. Why now? You know, I there's no real reason other than I've been writing the column. And I feel like it's sort of, the column has sort of gotten better since I started writing it. And at some point it was almost like I wished that the column was a daily column instead of a weekly column, because I feel like it's just a subject. I've written all kinds of different things. I started writing cartoons early on in my career. And then I was a TV critic for several years. I've written a lot of culture essays, for various places, but this writing, the advice column, is sort of like one of the most pure and inspired things that I've ever done. It's the writing just flows. I love doing it so much. And so I almost wish that I were writing it every day. So I just had more material than I could even publish on The Cut. So I just had extra stuff and felt like I wanted to put it all into a book. It's a kind of a good reason for writing a book. I've written books before where it was like, I need to sell a book and then write it. So this was more of a situation where I just felt very inspired to put a whole book together and be able to hold that advice in my hands and know that it's kind of feels like a concrete thing.
Yeah. I was going to ask you to describe your column, Ask Polly, for those who may not be familiar with it. But I think the best way to do that is to have you read one of your responses to a letter that you've gotten. I'm particularly fond of the letter in the book from the person who penned it, Weird Gal. And she is convinced that she's just too weird and out there to ever find a solid, long-lasting relationship. Could you read a little bit of that for us?
Oh, sure. She, you know, I love this letter because it's kind of a long letter, but she says, the beginning of it says, "Dear Polly, I'm weird. I've always been weird. People have been calling me that since I was a child. As I exit my 20s, it has abated, but I know people still think it. They use different words for it now, unique, funny, quirky, quite a character, but it all means the same thing, weird." So she sort of talks about how when she was in high school and she was in college, she tried to be more like Paris Hilton. She always dyed her hair blonde. She always had a tan. And she tried to fit in with all of the kind of Paris Hilton. She says, girls who looked like Paris Hilton and boys who looked like proto Jersey Shore douchebags is the word she uses. Like, you probably might have to take that out. But so she got really bored talking about normal things and talking and trying to be like regular people. And eventually her authentic weird self came out. But basically, she says that everything about her makes people a little crazy and throws people off. She has a stripper pole in her living room, but it's for fitness. Her whole apartment is pink, and it's covered in Hello Kitty everything, and she has a giant oil painting of herself and her dog hanging in her living room. She sounds like a really interesting person, but she also kind of has this interesting way of packaging herself where she sort of feels like she needs to market herself as a certain kind of person. And there's some underlying insecurity in the letter. And so my response to her was just that she was creating this false binary between normal and weird, and she kind of thinks that everyone is one thing or another. It's a very kind of reductive view of the world to think that we're all either completely acceptable, mainstream, regular, basic people, or we're crazy, wild, devil-may-care, mad, you know, confident, swaggery weirdos. I felt like she was selling herself a little bit too hard, and I kind of pushed her to sort of stop trying so hard and stop. You know, she has this, it becomes apparent during the course of her letter that she is telling these men that she meets everything about herself in the first few days of knowing them. And she is explaining everything about herself immediately, straight out of the gate. And it's almost like she's a lawyer who's making a case for herself at all times. When, you know, when you meet confident people who are legitimately weird and not afraid to show it, they're not necessarily making a case for weirdness every second of every day. They're just existing in the world and they're comfortable with who they are. So I tried to push her to just accept her for her who she is in her normal aspects and in her weird aspects. So in the end, what I write to her is, I say, I think you're in the middle of a transition. Some of your choices make sense to you and others feel outdated. Wear that on your sleeve. Resist the urge to reveal every inch of yourself or to invite people to your place immediately. Let them get to know you gradually. Practice sitting still in the presence of someone whose disappointment and lack of interest are becoming palpable. Sit with it instead of trying to convince them otherwise. Sit with it instead of getting defensive or angry. Practice saying, I'm opinionated, I'm a weirdo, I'm not for everyone. You're trotting out all your secrets right now. You can't do that until you feel good about your secrets and you accept that lots of people won't like you once they know who you are. That's true for anyone. A lot of people won't be into you. You will feel the pain of that for your entire life, trust me. You really should accept it and learn to deal with it, not by shutting people out or becoming defensive or rigid, but by paradoxically allowing people space to feel however they happen to feel and making small adjustments to how you move through the world based on what feels good and what doesn't. It's okay to be an oversensitive freak. Oversensitive freaks tend to overreact. They tend to spin in circles. But they are some of the most loyal, interesting, intense people around, and they just get better as they age. Welcome to the tribe, Polly.
And I love that, too, because you are welcoming to a tribe that you yourself, in the course of that, too, say, like, hey, I'm part of this tribe, too. I see at least some of myself in this letter, or at one point in my life, I have seen myself in your letter.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I tend to kind of be attracted to letters that have, there's some piece of it that I can relate to and that I understand, or there's just some kind of echo in my own life that where I can kind of crawl into that space of insecurity and that space of sort of not knowing what comes next. The whole book is really filled with my mistakes and my flaws. That's kind of like what, and my column is like that too. It's sort of what I do. And, you know, not everyone, I think, responds to that. Not everyone, that's not the perfect advice for all people. Some people kind of would prefer to get advice from someone who knows a lot more than them and hasn't screwed up as much as I've screwed up. But I think that's, for me, I like to understand that you know, we all go through the same things, essentially. I think it's something that's not part of our culture to acknowledge that we all sort of crawl through the same stuff. There's a lot of like, whatever, I went through that before, get over it, that comes from older people. And I feel like I'm offering something very humble to people when I say, yes, I remember that feeling and I have empathy for that.
Yeah. Well, and you raise a good point, too, about the different types of advice that people can seek. And it does seem like there's been this shift from the Miss Manners, Dear Abby kind of advice to more vulnerable, heart-wrenching, honest questions that people at least seem to be sending your way. Why do you think people are more, you know, kind of wearing their hearts on their sleeves when asking advice in this day?
Well, I mean, I think there are two opposite poles of kind of opposite trends in our culture at this moment. We have sort of one strain of culture that's very curated and very careful and very perfect. You're sort of like Beyonce, Kim Kardashian, you know, very curated selves that exist in the spotlight. And there's one strain of culture that's very focused on people should just improve. They should be living their best lives. We should all be improving ourselves to infinity and beyond. We should all be as perfect as we can possibly be. And then these very perfect, very polished human beings are held up to us as examples of what we're striving for. On the other hand, and then, you know, there's also the sort of strain of people are either winners or losers. You know, so the political campaigns have sort of latched onto this idea that some people are just losers and they'll never change. They will always be losers. And some people are just winners and they'll just keep winning forever. And the history of high capitalism is a history of the winners crushing the losers. I think that American culture in particular is very attached to that narrative. But on the other side of things, we have this equal and opposite movement that's very into the truth and very into looking at different kinds of people and saying, let's reexamine some of the narratives we're telling about our culture's supposed losers, and let's ask ourselves what situational and emotional factors play into someone deciding, you know, that play into our culture deciding that someone is a loser, and also play into a loser deciding that they're a loser. It's very easy as a sensitive person, as a smart person in our culture that is so binary in its thinking, to believe that the slightest hesitation brands you as a loser forever. And once you're seen as a loser, you are destined to lose and lose for the rest of time. I think a lot of people are showing their flaws and their deeper complexity and their layers of self-doubt and questioning at this moment for a reason. They're doing it because they want to be freed from this sort of false binary.
We're talking with Heather Havrilesky. She's a pop culture writer and advice columnist for New York Magazine. Her new book is How to Be a Person in the World, Ask Polly's Guide Through the Paradoxes of Modern Life. It combines some favorite columns from over the years as well as some new material. She's also a North Carolina native who grew up in Durham. We need to take a short break here. When we come back, we'll talk more about the book and hear about some bad advice she's received. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and South State Bank, a community bank with strong Southern roots since 1934, focusing on commercial banking, private banking, and wealth management. Information available at southstatebank.com. Coming up tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, there's been a lot of talk this election year about America's greatness, especially when it's the cornerstone of one of the presidential campaigns. But does the sales pitch behind America's brand match up with reality? A report this year actually ranked U.S. the fourth behind other nations when it comes to being the greatest. North Carolina is also wrestling with brand identity with the HB2 fallout. We'll talk with a marketing expert about the branding of the country when Charlotte Talks tomorrow at 9 here on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, for the first time in post-war history, Chancellor Angela Merkel's party finished behind a populist challenger in Germany's state elections. And in Denmark, growing backlash over a wave of asylum seekers, the rise of nationalist and anti-immigrant sentiment in Europe.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Sarah D'Elia in for Mike Collins. We're talking to Heather Havrileski. Her weekly advice column is called Ask Polly, and it's featured in New York Magazine. And she's also the author of the new book, How to Be a Person in the World. I wanted to ask you, Heather, what are your favorite questions to answer?
I definitely like questions that are... I like questions from people who sort of see part of their problem, but not all of their problem. I get a lot of really smart questions. New York Magazine has a lot of smart readers. And also just there are a lot of people who have been following my column for years who are just kind of have been waiting for the day to send in their question. And it's always very complicated. I love situations where someone identifies the problem, but the real problem is sort of in the subtext of the letter, if that makes any sense. But I get all kinds of different questions, and it's really just an embarrassment of riches. I feel like I can't, it's hard to decide. You know, usually I just blindly pick something and start running with it because it speaks to me at some level. Or I can relate sometimes to some dimension of it, and I feel like I have something to add to the, you know, to that particular problem.
Yeah. I've read in other interviews that you've done that you can tell when you've given a really good piece of advice. It seems like there's this gut feeling that you have where you're like, yeah, that was good. But I was wondering, have you, over the course of your career and your life, have you ever yourself gotten a piece of really bad advice that you were like, I know that is bad advice and I should never use this or bestow this on another person?
I was in college, and my dad's girlfriend told me that I should make sure to find a boyfriend, settle down with someone, a nice guy in college, because after I got out of college, I would find that there are very few interesting, smart, nice guys out in the world. And if I waited until after college to try to find someone, I would be very lonely. That was very bad advice, actually. I think her advice panicked me a little bit. I mean, she was in her 30s and she was dating my dad, who was divorced and had no intention of marrying her ever, or marrying anyone ever. I sort of thought, my God, she's beautiful and smart, and here she is in this bad situation. I better do what she says and find myself a husband really fast. And so I wanted to marry my college boyfriend, and then I wanted to marry my boyfriend after that, and then I wanted to marry my boyfriend after that. And I always saw the world of men as a game of scarcity, where there were just not enough men in the world, not enough good men, and I just needed to settle for whoever came along. And then at some point, I was dating this guy, and I finally broke up with him when I realized that he just was not going to grow up, and he was not going to want to get married or have kids ever, and he just really actually wasn't necessarily going to get a job ever. I was single for the first time in a long time, and I said to myself, who knows if I'll ever find a great guy? And a friend of mine said, you're never really single for that long. It always seems like you are single for maybe a month or two, and then someone else comes along. Like, you can pretend that you have so much trouble finding guys, and yet you're always on to the next relationship. And so then I shifted my focus, and I was like, my God, it's true. I'm usually only single for a few months, so I should really enjoy this time and savor it, because I'm probably not going to be single for long. And then all of a sudden that colored my vision of the world as a place filled with riches beyond compare and, you know, men coming out of the woodwork. I mean, I'm sure that the situation was exactly the same as it ever was, but it felt really good to see things through that lens. I mean, I think that a lot of my column actually comes around to this sort of the same sort of philosophy, which is, you know, you have a lot of control over your reality. You have a lot of control over how you experience the world. And if you think that the world is just a denuded, barren, dystopian landscape, that's kind of like the landscape you're going to be living in. But on the other hand, if you choose to to see things as, you know what, there are untold adventures in store for me. Suddenly the world, that your life tends to kind of conform to that expectation. It sounds kind of Pollyanna-esque, I think, but it's been true for me, definitely. So, yeah. So definitely, like, the bottom line is, if someone tells you, hurry up and settle down with a great guy immediately, as soon as you can, marry the guy you're with, whoever he is, definitely consider questioning that advice.
Well, now you're married, you have two daughters, and you're 46. But I've read that your audience is mostly millennials, are really drawn to what you have to say. And I myself am an older millennial and am drawn to what you have to say. Why do you think it is that we are flocking to your words?
I don't know. I mean, I think everyone... I'm not completely 100% in support of characterizing different generations as entirely different from each other. I think that millennials are really a lot like Gen Xers. And Gen Xers and millennials are actually a lot like boomers as well. We're all fallen idealists in our own terrible ways. I mean, I think that American culture is a culture of dreams and striving, and we believe great things about ourselves when we're young, and we all have really disappointing experiences at some point in our lives. I think when you're in your 20s and your early 30s, there's a kind of energy to, like, trying to figure out all the things in your life at once and trying to have a great career and trying to make your mark and trying to fall in love and find true love and have a kind of like a safe, secure, wonderful life, but also have adventures, all the things we expect of ourselves. It's hard to get those things in place, especially today when jobs are insecure, when people don't stay in one place very long. So you can have a lot of friends and then they can all move to a different town. But life is very transient and insecure and uncertain at this time. I mean, I'm sure that every generation has said that, but it definitely feels true today. And I had a lot of struggles in my 20s. I think that I just relate to that time a lot. I like reliving those struggles, possibly because I'm a crazy person and I love to suffer. But I think that there's something really sympathetic about the way that millennials in particular, I guess, are characterized as trying to find a kind of pure, real, true, idealistic way to live. You know, they reject a lot of the things that boomers and Gen Xers also rejected, if you go back in history and look at the way we behaved. And they want to write their own stories. And I think that's an admirable thing. I think it's really hard to do, you know? So that's where I connect with it. I mean, on the one hand, we're all a lot alike. And then on the other hand, I think it's a really hard time to be young right now. Social media puts all kinds of pressures on us. Like I said, the career market is not what it could be for a lot of people. The economy is strange. I mean, there are just a lot of things about our culture that are tough on young people.
Well, what I like about your book, and getting back to that, is that it covers the funny, it covers the heart-wrenching, and it also covers real trauma that people face in their lives and open up to you about. For example, there's a woman who writes to you about a sexual assault that she experienced, and the person who assaulted her was a former friend of hers, a friend at the time. And she writes to you about this really painful process of explaining this to mutual friends about this traumatic experience. And to make a long story short, in her letter, she explains that some friends believe her, support her, and others just don't. Could you read a little bit of your response to her?
Sure. Okay, so her letter, I write to her that her letter reminds me of a Daniel Johnston song called Devil Town.
I was living in Devil Town. Didn't know it was Devil Town.
She's been living in this evil kind of place without knowing it, and it's like she woke up one morning and she discovered that all her friends were vampires and everything she knew and believed in was an illusion.
All my friends were vampires. I didn't know they were vampires.
We all go through times in our lives when the things that we believe in are tested, and also the people around us are tested. If someone close to you dies when you're in your 20s, it's really remarkable how half the people you know rally to your side and support you, and the other half just cannot deal with the heaviness and they avoid you. And so she's kind of in a situation where she's got a lot of friends who were on her side and understood her the terrible position she was in. And then these other two friends sort of rallied to the side of this guy who had assaulted her, which was just crazy, and then got mad at her for playing the victim, as they called it, and scapegoating this guy who had assaulted her, who, you know, I mean, he assaulted her. It was pretty clear, pretty obvious. So what I say to her is, it sounds like this guy never apologized. He shrugged it off, apparently never owned up to his other aggressive acts, never addressed this insane predatory behavior that cropped up in the midst of his drinking. I mean, basically, they were good friends, and all of a sudden he got wasted and started grabbing at her and was malicious about it. He wasn't, she ended up running away from him out into the street to get away from him, and he still didn't own up to what he had done after, you know, there are witnesses that saw this happen. So basically, there are signs that he never faced up to what he did. And so this is what I told her in response. Sure, at first glance, your friends are merely supporting their buddy and helping him get his life back together. But have they heard you out and respected your feelings about what this guy did to you? Did they understand his offense in the first place? No, they don't get sexual assault, or they wouldn't refer to the person you think hurt you. So she's on Facebook and this guy says, I don't know why you have to blame this person who you think hurt you. Basically, he went to great lengths to make it sound like everything had occurred in her head, which he knew how. You know, he knew because he decided that, essentially. So he was doubting her actual experience, but acting like he was the expert of her experience somehow. Really crazy. So I wrote in my response, I'm sorry, this response is hard because it's really long. You sensed this all along. You chose to assume they understood your pain, but they wanted to support their friend. You addressed the situation with the two of them directly. You agreed to disagree and you moved on, perfectly mature and not a bad choice. But do you see how you had to do the bending and they didn't do a thing to facilitate that? Then you saw the friend interacting with a jerk and it upset you. Totally natural that it would upset you. You confronted him. And while it probably wasn't completely fair to take him to task for being friends with this guy when you'd said you accepted it, what came out of that interaction? You learned that he never took your account seriously. His attitude was, forget what you think happened. You're wrong. I wasn't there, but I've decided independently that you're making it up. That was under the surface of all your interactions with that friend all along. Forget that guy. He's not your friend. I would move on knowing that you've expressed yourself clearly, not through a chat or on Facebook, but on paper. I'm telling her she should write a letter to him and be done with it. I don't know if that's the best advice, actually, now that I read it. The wisest thing might be just to accept that these guys are blind and stay out of their lives. They have the luxury of not having to see. And they have the luxury of not having to see the luxury of their blindness. They would rather call the seeing world crazy than open their eyes. But if you feel strongly enough about it, you may owe it to yourself to address your feelings with them, if only for your own peace of mind. It's okay. Your eyes are wide open.
And I imagine, especially with a topic like that of sexual assault, I mean, is it difficult to hear something like this and to really take someone's problem in like that? And I mean, does it stay with you? Do you carry that, or are you able to just kind of answer the letter and let it go?
I try really hard to get to into a space of being kind of devastated by what someone's going through in order to address it. It almost feels like you have to put yourself in someone's shoes. Otherwise, you're at risk of just saying, here's what I'm, here's my advice to you from on high, from a removed position, while I feel nothing about these things. But after I'm done answering a letter, unless I'm rereading it, which can be a problem and sometimes makes me cry when I reread it, I ran into that problem when I was recording my book, my audiobook, actually, because when I was reading my responses out loud, I kept crying in the middle of reading them. But other than that, yeah, I mean, I kind of try to put it behind me, honestly. I mean, I'm a strange kind of person. I'm sort of like, I think this is what makes me good at what I do, but it's also an unusual kind of person to be giving advice. I'm kind of half sensitive, soft, touchy-feely, pro-feelings human, and half kind of a tough robot lady. So at any given time, I'm like advising people to be softer and kinder to themselves and to feel their feelings. And then at other times, I am kind of like, you know, shut that down and proceed and just be capable and face the world without overanalyzing everything.
So how do you decide which way to respond to someone then? Is it touchy-feely, pro-feelings human, or more tough robot lady? How do you choose how best to respond?
Well, there are different times for different approaches, right? I mean, there are times when the thing is, it depends on what someone brings to the table. There are people who say, well, you know, I am this bundle of nerves and everything gets under my skin and I just can't get out the door in the morning. I can't face anything. And it's like sometimes people like that need to be acknowledged and empathized with more. And other times they just need to hear, you got to pull yourself together and wash your face and get out there and face the world. And then other people come to you and they're sort of like, I'm doing great. Everything is perfect. The only problem is this person in my life who's ruining everything. And then you have to say, okay, this person is getting under your skin and bothering you. And let's look at the source of those feelings. Like, you're going to have to soften up and be a little more vulnerable if you're going to solve this problem.
We're talking with Heather Havrileski. She's a pop culture writer and advice columnist for New York Magazine. Her new book is How to Be a Person in the World, Ask Polly's Guide Through the Paradoxes of Modern Life. We need to take a short break here. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and O2EMC, an independent power producer that develops, owns, and operates solar farms across the Southeast, dedicated to maximizing local jobs and clean energy generation. Info at O2EMC.com. Coming up next at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, for the first time in post-war history, Chancellor Angela Merkel's party finished behind a populist challenger in German state elections. And in Denmark, growing backlash over a wave of asylum seekers, the rise of nationalist and anti-immigrant sentiment in Europe. That's the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 here on 90.7 WFAE. We'll have more of our conversation on Charlotte Talks in just a moment.
News happens everywhere. Overseas.
At
At first, refugees rest in the shade near a train line just inside Croatian territory.
Around the country.
At the Napa County Fairgrounds in Calistoga, more than 600 evacuees woke up to overcast skies.
Wherever you are.
The U.S. will probably end up bringing many, many Syrians to the United States to live.
All Things Considered takes you to the story. Listen every afternoon.
Weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Sarah D'Elia. We're discussing North Carolina native and advice columnist Heather Havrileski's new book called How to Be a Person in the World. It features a collection of her never-before-published material from her column Ask Polly, along with some fan favorites. Heather, I wanted to ask you, I've heard you describe the letters as stories that you get, which I really like that description. It's almost like when you're writing back to someone, it's a possible next chapter, it's an offering, it's advice to what someone might do. Is there a particular letter that just has stuck with you throughout your years of giving advice?
Yeah, there's a letter that I included in the book where this woman says, I'm tired of dating tepid men. I can't stand the lukewarm reaction I get from men all the time, and I'm tired of trying to convince people to fall in love with me. And I'm beating myself up. I think there must be something wrong with me. Men never like me enough. I get a lot of letters like that, but this particular letter was one of the first I had ever gotten, and my reply was sort of like, envision a person who doesn't tolerate wishy-washiness in his or her life. And then I go into the fact that Kanye West is just such a person. and then the whole column is sort of like, what would Kanye do in this situation? And then I have a rap that I, it's a really strange letter and a strange response. But that one is one of my favorites because there are times when you just stumble on a really bad metaphor and somehow it works anyway and it's just great and everything you want to say can be filtered through this crazy metaphor. When I get into a space like that, I just love writing that kind of response. And I think that it was, I mean, what's strange is it's sort of this clumsy, ridiculous, outrageous reply, but it's good advice and it's actually kind of a beautiful essay. I compliment myself so strongly. But that one was just magical to me. It kind of came together and through the power of Kanye, it became a great thing. Advice is everywhere. You know, people give each other, hand each other the same cliches to deal with their problems over and over again in our lives. And so I'm really looking for a new way of saying old things. It's not like I'm rediscovering the secrets to happiness or the true nature of the human condition. I'm just, doing my best to empathize and give my perspective on things. And so there are times when I just need, the response needs to become prose. It needs to be a poem. It needs to be an angry sermon, in a lot of ways. It needs to be so many things in order to shake people out of, just live your best life, do your best, go out there and try harder. If you really want to touch people and get them to see what they're in, the space they're in a new way, it takes kind of a Herculean effort. And there are times when that Herculean effort is so easy at the same time and it just flows so well that it's just, I love it. I love writing this column more than anything I've ever written. And I've been writing professionally for 20 years. So that says a lot. I feel like it's a worthy use of my talents. I had somebody on Twitter telling me that it was sad that I used to write really smart things for this website called suck.com back in the 90s. And now I'm just writing vacuous girl advice for girls. And it made me laugh because, when I was younger, I probably would have felt insulted by that. But I think that the stuff I'm doing is anything but vacuous. It's sort of like the heaviest, most important things in the world are so often characterized as feminine. And of course, because they're feminine, they're also worthless. That perspective just amuses me to no end because we're talking about the most important things in the world, emotions and how to live a good life. There's nothing more important than that. And if you're addressing these things in an intelligent way, they're worthwhile. It's like you're basically trying to create a philosophy, a poetic philosophy of life. That's a pretty high bar to set for yourself. And I think that I set the bar high for myself. I really love what I do. So no matter how much, you know, society might undervalue, I mean, at times overvalue too, for sure. But no matter how people might react in passing to like, oh, this is just some silly thing that ladies like, I I'm fine with that. I feel like I'm in the right place.
Yeah. Well, I have to tell you that we put a call out to our listeners beforehand, letting them know that we'd be talking to you to see if anybody was in need of some advice. And we got a couple, and there's one in particular that I wanted to read to you. It's a short little email that we got. Are you game for giving some advice on the fly?
Sure. Yeah. This should be terrible.
I think this is, we picked this one because it's about love, and that's a lot of, I feel like a lot of people are seeking your love advice and happiness there. So this is from a listener named Stephanie who writes, how do I get through the pain of a bad breakup and come out on the other side where I can embrace my life as it is more than I mourn what it used to be?
I think the first thing I'd say is, mourning what it used to be is a huge part of embracing what it is. You know, it's like until you do the really hard work of staying in that space where you're saying goodbye to who you were. I mean, because saying goodbye to a past relationship, to a broken, you know, to a relationship that you have to put behind you, it includes saying goodbye to the self that you are with that person. I mean, I think the thing that I loved about falling in love when I was younger, and I was in, I don't know, 8 2-year relationships, something like that. I mean, I always hit the wall at 2 years, but I was always, I sort of put my heart and soul into each thing. And each time a relationship died, I just felt like part of me was dying with it. You know, you have so many hopes and dreams that are attached to that person too. And it's almost like you feel like you can't be the same person without the person you've lost, you know? So I think that if you don't give enough time to that mourning process, you end up, I don't know, rebounding. I mean, I've rebounded a bunch of times, and basically what rebounding means is trying to fill the hole of a certain person with another person that doesn't fit into that hole. And also getting involved with someone too quickly and then kind of missing the person that came before in the middle of your new relationship, which is a very uncomfortable, bad feeling. I mean, it happens. It's not like you can't get past that, but it's just like mourning someone's death. You know, it's like if you don't lean into it and feel all the things you're meant to feel about losing someone, you kind of never get over it in some ways. There's a piece of you that's always sort of, I mean, it's not like you ever get over someone who dies, but if you don't fully mourn, you kind of carry around this sadness with you, and it affects other parts of your life. So the first thing I'd say would be try to really stay in the place of sadness, because there's a point where you actually end up feeling like, okay, I've been sad for a long time now, and I think I'm ready to crawl out of this. Part of being sad about losing someone is kind of about looking clearly at what you actually had with them. And that means if you don't acknowledge all of the good you had with someone, you can't also see all of the bad things that you had with them and all the ways that you didn't match and you didn't necessarily understand each other. So mourning includes understanding what, you know, the bad things that were there that weren't working for you. And then when you feel like you've gone through that and you're done with it and you're really like ready to move on, I think part of the next stage is just, I mean, it's pretty obvious, but celebrating who you are in a vacuum of other defining people. I mean, thinking and feeling a lot about how you want to feel in the world without anyone by your side. And also, what do you need another person for? Like, what were the ways that you gave this person who's gone a lot of your power? And how can you prevent doing that as you move forward? I think we all tend to, within the course of a relationship that's not working, yield a lot of our personal power and a lot of our personal decision-making ability and a lot of our spirit to another person. And so the stage that comes after mourning is regaining your belief in yourself and your lust for life, kind of like regaining your passion for who you are outside of that person. Defining yourself as a force to be reckoned with, I think, is the next stage, you know? And then, you know, then it's sort of a matter of keeping your heart open and your eyes open and going out into the world and seeing people clearly and letting in a lot of different interesting people and making space for them. I mean, I think that there can be this stage where you feel like, I've got to go out there and find another to replace this guy or else I'm going to be alone forever. And that's not, you don't want to move to that kind of greedy, grabby state. Would you want to just stay in an open space where you let people show themselves to you, kind of, instead of like, I'm looking for this one kind of person. You go out and you say, who are the people out there? I haven't been on the market in a long time. Like, what's going on? Who exists? What do I like in other people? What do I really want in a love relationship?
Yeah. Well, you have people writing advice to you. You have people in radio interviews asking advice. I mean, this is your profession. So like sometimes I can't help but ask people lots of questions because that's what I do for a living. Do you find yourself giving advice even if they may not have asked for it?
Oh, yeah. But I mean, I always did that. When I was young, I would go out to parties and drink and tell people what I thought was their big problem. I mean, it was encountered, not surprisingly, as a very aggressive behavior. But you know, I actually had really good intentions. I feel like I was a sensitive kid, and I could see people kind of clearly, and I would see things quickly, and I would have this, you know, flash of inspiration, and I would want to say, oh, you're the kind of person who wants this, but what you really need is this, and people would just, oh, they did not like me. I made lots of quick enemies out in the world when I was younger. So now it's like I've arrived in this dream world where people actually want to know what I think about things, and it's kind of absurd. I'm sure a lot of my oldest friends are rolling their eyes when they hear me say that because, you know, I mean, the people who are closest to you are the least likely to take your advice. It's strangers. It's much easier to get advice from a stranger, and it's much easier to trust a stranger when you're looking for advice. It just feels more objective, you know. If people know you too well, you feel like they're prejudiced. And also, you know how they live, you know. If you knew how I live, you might not want advice from me at all, you know, who knows. But yeah, I give people advice constantly. I probably give people advice a little bit less than I used to now that I do it professionally. I've sort of expunged that impulse a little bit more through my professional life, thank God. So I'm not torturing people as much as I used to. Yeah.
Well, I want to make sure that I ask this question before we let you go. With the title of your book being How to Be a Person in the World, what have you learned through this process of collecting these columns and organizing them and putting them into the book? Like, what have you learned about being a person in the world?
I've learned a lot. It's strange. I mean, you know, over the course of writing the column, I have learned a great deal. And I think the central thing that I come back to over and over again as a very moody person, because I feel like the person that I wake up with every day is just different. Like I feel like a different person every few days, every few weeks. I feel like an entirely different person than I was before. And it's always bewildering and unexpected. Like for the past 2 weeks, I've been just a little bit kind of low energy and also just a little bit biting. Like things are making me mad. I'm impatient, not with my kids or my husband, but just in the world itself, kind of the things that I want to write about, the things that I notice. I'm sort of like, give me someone to get into. I just want to fight with people right now. I don't know what's going on with me. And I think that in the past, it's kind of unusual. Like I haven't been in this fighting mode for about a year, I'd say. But I think in the past, if I'd find myself in a new place, which I did all the time, I would feel guilty for it. I mean, I just have this knee-jerk guilt about anything that's, you know, supposedly negative emotion that I'm feeling, any way that I'm being that's less than, you know, that's suboptimal, not completely perfect and majestically good and generous. I think that I've learned not to feel guilty about every single new place I find myself in. And I've learned not to feel guilty I've learned to show myself a little bit of empathy. I don't know how to love myself necessarily. I never really connected with that concept. Like, I love myself. It just sounds crazy to me. But I feel like I've learned to accept what is. So if I wake up in a bad space, I just give a little space for that. And I accept myself, even though I'm sort of feeling nasty or impatient or lazy, you know, is a good one for a writer. And the more that I do that, the happier I am. It's hard to be nice to people and be generous to people and to give to people. It's hard to be a good mother. It's hard to be a good partner if you're not nice to yourself, if you have no empathy for yourself. I find that the more empathy I have for myself, the more I can give empathy to other people. And so that if there's one lesson that I've learned through doing this, it's that. It's like as long as you're impatient and angry at yourself, you're going to spread that energy to other people and feed that out into other people. And when you give people empathy and when you give people love without them giving you anything in return, when you go out into the world and really give everyone the benefit of the doubt that you meet, magical things happen. Great things happen. The world is transformed into a place where people are loving and kind. It sounds crazy, but that's the way I've kind of been living. It's a beautiful thing. It's strange because so much of it lies within your perceptions and your kind of treatment of yourself. It sounds navel-gazy, but actually the results are very, actually the most unselfish thing.
That's Heather Havrilesky. She's the Ask Polly columnist for New York Magazine, and her new book is How to Be a Person in the World. Heather, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Sarah, it was so nice talking to you. Thanks for having me on your show. I really appreciate it.
I'm Sarah D'Elia, filling in for Mike Collins. This has been Charlotte Talks.